the top stories. Vote counting for the contentious U.S. presidential election drags on for a third day as the winner remains unclear. U.S. President Donald Trump's campaign files a lawsuit on what it calls vote irregularities in Nevada after losing court rulings in Georgia and Michigan states. Also ahead, a UK Parliament watchdog says Britain's trade with the EU faces major disruption, regardless of whether a trade deal is agreed. Vote counting for the U.S. presidential election enters a third day with no clear winner in the race for the White House. In Georgia, some 99% of the votes have been counted. Democratic candidate Joe Biden is now leading over incumbent Donald Trump by nearly 1,000 votes there. Biden is also leading in the states of Nevada, where ballot counting is still underway. Votes are being counted in Pennsylvania and North Carolina as well. The two states, along with Michigan, Georgia, and Wisconsin, are key battleground states that are yet to declare a winner in the presidential election. The delay is because states have different laws on counting mail-in ballots. Friday is the last deadline for mail-in ballots to be counted. U.S. President Donald Trump has once again hurled accusations at Democrats claiming they are engineering the presidential election.
And there are many instances which will be reported very shortly. There's tremendous litigation going on, and this is a case where they're trying to steal an election. They're trying to rig an election, and we can't let that happen. Detroit and Philadelphia, known as two of the most corrupt political places anywhere in our country.
Trump added that if, quote, legal votes are counted, he will easily win the race. He once again lashed out at the mail-in voting system, calling it a one-sided method that benefits Democrats. The Trump campaign has filed lawsuits to halt vote counting in Nevada, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, while claiming vote irregularities in Georgia. State judges in Georgia and Michigan, however, have rejected the suit, citing lack of evidence. In the meantime, Democratic candidate Joe Biden expressed confidence that he will be elected as the next U.S. president after the vote counting process ends.
We have no doubt that when the count is finished, Senator Harris and I will be declared the winners. So, I ask everyone to stay calm, all the people to stay calm. The process is working. The count is being completed.
The Democratic candidate stressed that each ballot must be counted. The race is tight in Georgia, like I said at the beginning, Nevada, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania. Mr. Biden needs only six more electoral votes to secure the 270 required to win the nail-biter race. Trump has won so far 214. Final results can take days to be announced, as counting mail-in ballots is said to be a time-taking process. It's time for our news review. Please stay with us. Welcome to this hour's news review that has to do with the U.S. presidential election and one of the issues that surrounds it. Republicans are divided over Mr. Trump's allegations of election fraud and his demand for stopping the vote count. Senator Mitt Romney said counting every vote is at the heart of democracy. He said the process is often long and frustrating, but that does not mean it should stop. Republican representative for Illinois Adam Kinzinger said Trump should stop spreading debunked misinformation. Maryland Governor Larry Hogan said there is no defense for Trump's post-election comments and urged him to respect the results. That is while two other Republican senators have supported the president. Ted Cruz said Pennsylvania's attorney general had ordered vote counting to continue in Philadelphia until Biden wins. Lindsey Graham also said Philadelphia elections are crooked. We'll be discussing that situation with guests who join us for this part of the program. Polina Aniftu, foreign policy analyst, who joins us via Skype at Paphos in Cyprus. It's good to have you, Polina. And Mr. Paolo Raffone is a secretary general with CIPI or CP Foundation, whichever is correct. out of Brussels via Skype. Thank you very much, guests. You know, I guess nothing is more interesting to see, not only that the country, it seems to be very divided over who wants or who is favored to win, but within one party there is rift as to how Mr. Trump is commenting on the situation regarding vote counting. I'm going to get the first reaction to that from Polina.
Well, actually, we were expecting that. Before I came to this interview, I was looking at the map and I just saw Georgia is turning blue. Yeah. So actually, Mr. Biden is getting there, first. So we're expecting to happen this one. And, from the very beginning of the year, that this kind of researchers and this kind of analysts, that they were coming and say, it's a high-risk situation in the United States, not only the outcome of the elections, but also the debate that's going to happen during the elections and after the elections. They knew from the very beginning that the outcome is going to be doubted and the legitimacy of the outcome as well by Mr. Trump. And actually, we were expecting this, and I have to say it was quite expected because we have seen the reactions of Mr. Trump concerning Guaido in Venezuela, that actually he self-declared himself as a president. So actually, 2 days ago, Mr. Trump, he's done the same. He self-declared himself as the winner of these elections. Mm. But, at the very beginning, we see a country that at the moment is out of control and it doesn't have any kind of government.
Mm. Polina, I'm sorry to stop you. Do you have any idea or does that interest you in any way? That's where I want to ask you this question. In any way that people within his own party are saying, don't say this, or actually are supporting him in what he says?
Well, actually, it's not only the poor and the not educated people that he was sponsoring them, and actually he was trying to approach them. We see that he was involved in many lobbies. For example, he was giving money to people and low taxes to people to buy guns. It was the whole thing with the hate and against the black people and the Latin America. It was what happened with Mexico. So there is a kind of group in the United States that they live this kind of exceptionalism and this kind of priority and supremacy of the white race or the wealth race, and they just support him. What we see from his supporters, it's obvious. In the one state, they go and they say stop counting, and then they go to the other state and they say, count all the votes.
Okay.
And sure. You know, the problem at the moment that the United States they are facing is a kind of doubts about the in-house institution. So any the outcome that is going to come, we don't see any moral and democratic elections at the moment.
Sure. Paulo, in Brussels, of course, when you have people supporting you from within your own party, you know, there is nothing to be surprised at. But it is when you have people within your own party saying, don't say this, man, that is when, you know, everybody gets surprised. Does that surprise you?
Not really, because on one side, it's normal that when you are on the winning side, everybody follows you. When you are on the losing side, you start losing support from within your ranks. So this is not completely surprising, although Mr. Trump has managed to control quite a lot of his party and the appointments made within his party. But we have seen also some of the results that came out of these elections made past certain contenders within the Republicans to Mr. Trump's idea of the party. So that's why you have this split within. The fact is that the fight that is going on now within each party, especially within the Republican Party, is because the transversal globalist approach that involves also the Democrats has taken a part of the Republicans, because finally that goes back to the old good way of making business in the United States through Wall Street and the conglomerate of financial and military industries. So this is what we are seeing, the return of the bloc.
All right. Back to Polina in Paphos now. Polina, of course, you have a situation where, you know, a lot of people have been saying over the past days because of the fact that, honestly, a few people really even within the U.S., they really thought that Mr. Trump is getting these numbers that he has. You know, a lot of people had anticipated that he would have a resounding defeat, so to speak. But the numbers have raised the hopes for the Republican Party, at least for a portion of them, that perhaps, knowing Mr. Trump, that we know he is, that he is going to run in 2024, and perhaps if a person can garner this many votes right now in the U.S. presidential election against someone like Joe Biden, perhaps who's better than him to run in 2024. How do you put this together with the infighting inside the party that is going on right now, that is going to work for perhaps both the Republican Party and Mr. Trump come 2024?
When it comes to United States, United States, they come and they say to the rest of the world and they speak about democracy, but actually the election systems that they have in the United States is bipolar. So it's Democrats and Republicans. So the people actually, they don't have many options. It's one of these two parties. It's not like, for example, in other countries or even Iran that they have the right to vote something else. So usually they are focusing to these two parties, and this is actually the mentality of the people and the mentality of the country. Mr. Trump, during the elections and during his campaign, he accused many times his party, saying that it was not really aware of what's going on in the States, and actually they didn't move fast. So I believe that now, after the elections, as we see that probably he's going to lose, and he's not going to be the president anymore. I'm not sure that the Republican Party, they want to keep him in. So I see that or he's going to lead any kind of, not party, but movement. But from the other side, even if he stays in the party, he's going to have a kind of movement to influence the Republicans. The problem with Mr. Trump is that he doesn't have, coming back to his political career and ideas, he doesn't have a kind of limit. So actually he doesn't limit himself into very democratic, to the democratic principles. So we see that the Republican Party and that he's going to affect in the future, probably they're going to be an obstacle to the reforms that Mr. Biden is going to bring into the parliament and everything. From the other side, we're going to see that it's going to create a terrible political risk for the next year. And we're going to see that the United States market and the international markets, that at the moment they're getting a little bit smaller because they see Biden to be the president. Probably they're going to face huge issues for the next of the year of 2020 when they see that Trump is interrupted. Mm-hmm. Of course, even we say these kind of things because a lot of people, they see him that he's responsible because of the pandemic. We speak about 230,000 people dead in the United States. We talk about the mother of pharmaceuticals and the mother of capitalism, and this country didn't manage, to cure the people, to care about the people. He was the obstacle to Obama.
So of course, there are other issues, Paulina, at work. You touched upon something really nice, and that gave me the idea as to my next question instead of my own. Whether the Republicans really want to keep him in as an asset, are they really looking at him? And that's the final question for you and for both of you guests. Paulo, do you think that they're going to keep him in as an asset? What is the outlook of him on the part of the Republicans right now? Do they look at him as an asset or somebody who has made this rift among their ranks and perhaps keeping him in will be dangerous and will create even more rifts?
And this is a bit too early to say, but certainly it is not of any advantage to keep someone who has lost the elections in a position to lead the party. So there will be, I think, a lot of rifts within the Republican Party also, because when Trump came in, he faced already a certain degree of resistance. And this is also seen in the election outcome. Look at Arizona, which is a McCain campus, basically, and he didn't win there because he was not supported. So that's the situation. Probably there would be a redefinition of American politics altogether. The system as it is probably does not correspond anymore to the complexity of the society. And the outcome of these elections is that the country is split, not reconcilable in an easy way. institutions may be misfunctioning. So something has to be fixed in the United States.
All right. Thank you very much. That's Mr. Paolo Raffone, Secretary General with CIPI or CP Foundation out of Brussels via Skype. I also had the pleasure of speaking to Polina Neftu, foreign policy analyst out of PAFOS Cyprus. Thank you very, very much. Thanks for being with us with this news review. Welcome back. Rival rallies have been held across the U.S. for the second straight night over the election vote count. President Trump's supporters, some with weapons, gathered outside the vote counting facility in Las Vegas. That's the most populous city in the state of Nevada, where election ballots are still being processed. Trump supporters included members of the far-right group Proud Boys. They carried flags that say, "Don't steal my vote." Pro-Trump supporters gathered in New York and Philadelphia, too. Both cities also saw rival protests calling for every vote to be counted. Demonstrations were triggered on Wednesday after Trump claimed that he had been cheated out of winning the election. He has offered no evidence for his claim, though. 17 states across the U.S. have reported record daily increases of COVID-19 infections as the country registers a record number of over 123,000 new cases. Number of hospitalized patients continue to rise for the 11th day in a row, reaching over 52,500. Furthermore, the country's average daily fatalities also rose to 850. Some cities and states have taken measures to curb the virus surge by imposing curfews or reducing gathering sizes. However, 17 out of 50 American states do not have mandatory mask rules. The pandemic has spread across the country, but it has affected the Midwest worse. Illinois and Texas are the leading states in number of cases in the last 7 days. Our last headline story, a UK Parliament watchdog says Britain's trade with the European Union faces major disruption, regardless of whether a trade deal is reached. The National Audit Office said ports and businesses are not ready for January the 1st, when the Brexit transition period ends. The body said the UK government is attempting to prepare new border controls, which pose high risks. The office added that the coronavirus pandemic will make the situation even worse. London and Brussels are engaged in intensive talks to work out their future trade ties. Prospects for a deal looks dim as lots of moot points remain. And that's it with international news.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Here the sound of life flows. IRIB English Radio.
Iran Today.
Iran and America, once fast friends, turned foe 40-plus years ago with Iran's Islamic Revolution of 1979. But were they ever friends? Platonic friends on a par, that is. Iranians remember no less than some 60 years of bilateral underlying enmity, beginning with U.S. bullying. How can you beat a bully? You can't very well be a bigger bully than the biggest, even if you want to. And that's partly why Iran was pulled towards an anti-imperialist revolution, and till today has resistance at the top of its agenda. But what made Iranians suspect America all those years ago before the revolution? And can a Democrat such as Biden make a difference all these decades later to unlock closed doors and open a path for talks between Iran and the U.S.? I'm Leila Faramayzi in Iran Today. A day particularly marked in bad blood between Iran and the U.S. is the 4th of November, or 13th of Aban on the Iranian calendar. This year it coincided with the 3rd of November, but it has been no less eventful. It is still the anniversary of Students' Day and the U.S. Embassy takeover in Iran. And in the U.S., it's marked Election Day, after debates between a highly controversial Republican and a level-headed Democrat. Mr. Sadatian is a U.S.-Iran affairs expert. It was a pleasure to hear him at Press TV Studios. Iranians have never fully trusted the U.S. and its policies, even before the revolution. Why so?
Pessimism vis-a-vis the U.S. is mainly rooted in the 1953 coup against the Mossadegh government. Until that event, or up to World War II, the U.S. was not much involved in colonialism, I mean externally, as it had realized colonialist projects internally. But after that, it gradually found a black image in the countries where it interfered. The Iran issue is a case in point, as the Americans were duped by the Britons into getting involved with the 1953 coup. Many related events followed, including Nixon's visit to Tehran and the death of Iranian students. That, along with similar incidents, made Iranians pessimistic about the Americans.
I've also another U.S.-Iran expert here with the right brain cells for a logical analysis of interstate relations. That would be Mr. Abolfat.
The Islamic Republic of Iran took great strides to reach an understanding. It even ignored its demands in order to reach a win-win deal, but the Americans broke their pledges, as the Europeans have acknowledged it. Furthermore, the atmosphere of mutual confidence built at that time was damaged, while it could extend to non-nuclear issues too. Therefore, the Islamic Republic of Iran had no other option than resistance. It was Iran's sole choice, particularly after Mr. Trump came to power. Maximum resistance against maximum pressure.
November the 4th, 1979, is a symbol of the confrontations between two forces in the history of the Islamic Republic. The founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, was exiled to Turkey on November the 4th, 1964, for protesting the Shah's affiliations. Dozens of Iranian students were killed on November the 4th, 1978, before the revolution, in protest to U.S. affiliations at home. And finally, the capture of the U.S. Embassy was on November the 4th, 1979, year of the revolution. This was the end of the counter-revolutionary actions of the embassy in Iran. When Imam Khomeini was faced with the action, he referred to the embassy takeover as the Second Revolution. The celebration of this day, Students' Day, is a celebration of the efforts of a country that has aspired to stand against the desired order of a superpower. Interestingly, Donald Trump also chose the same day in 2018 to reinstate sanctions on Iran.
The Americans maintain that Iran disrupts any order. The U.S. is a superpower and has spent $8 trillion realizing their regional ambitions. Thousands of U.S. servicemen have died in the Afghanistan and Iraq wars in order to restore order. The Americans say Iran complied with the world order up to 1979, but it turned to revolutionism afterwards.
Referring to his opponent, Biden, on the question of whether level heads might think for themselves henceforth or continue to be guided by policies set by their predecessors, as has been the case with U.S. presidential successions, our next guest says, let's see what Mr. Ajorlu has to say. He's editor-in-chief of the political magazine Mosallas.
It would be both correct to say it would make a difference or would make a difference. You may ask why. It's because of political psychology, policy making, international relations. That would make people and parties different from one another. A case in point is the difference between Obama and Bush Jr. So was the case with Bush Sr. and Bush Jr., Mitt Romney, Colin Powell or McCain would be totally different from Trump, were they elected president? However, they are the same regarding the Americans' objective of containing Iran and causing the country to change its behavior.
Democratic presidents of the United States have evidently not refrained from any blows against Iran. The string of sanctions Iran's post-revolution history has been decorated with were colorfully named by Republicans and Democrats alike. Executive sanctions against Iran began with Democrat Jimmy Carter. Clinton later took important steps to hit the Iranian economy with his unprecedented sanctions. The Obama administration, especially Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, was at the forefront of all U.S. administration sanctions against the Iranian people with painful sanctions. Suffice to look at her book, Hard Choices, and see how she committed herself to cutting off Iran's oil, or lifeblood. She made every effort to build an international consensus against Iran.
Would it make any difference to Iran if a Democrat such as Biden got in or a Republican such as Trump?
Donald Trump and Joe Biden could not be viewed as totally different. Both may create opportunities and threats for the Islamic Republic of Iran. We cannot say Biden is good and Trump is bad. If Biden comes into power, he would create both opportunities and threats for Iran. So is the case with Trump. If he's re-elected, the current sanctions will continue to remain in effect. However, Trump would also create some opportunities for Iran without really meaning it. Therefore, we cannot say this one is good and that one is bad.
We must not forget that in the 8 years of Obama's presidency, Joe Biden was the first vice president. In fact, the sanctions Trump reinstated against Iran were mostly imposed by the Democratic administration. But with Trump re-elected, things could get a lot uglier than the economic war on Iran, which is sanctions.
We are resisting here while Trump continues to stick with his policy of applying maximum pressure on Iran. That may lead to military confrontation. If it happens, it would create tensions in the region. Some nations are trying to prevent such confrontation, but Trump has shown in practice that he will continue with his policy if he wins the election.
It's a wonder how the U.S. administration has gotten its people to believe the pursuit of Iran and wars on West Asia are worth the trillions of dollars it's spent. Regarding Iran, Mr. Biden will continue the path of trying for talks and playing the sanctions game, according to Mr. Sadatian.
If Mr. Biden is elected, Democrats would opt for multilateralism in regional talks with Iran. But Mr. Trump would resort to bullying and force to impose his own views on the Islamic Republic. But Iran has so far resisted and refused to buckle down.
The U.S. Embassy, 50 years ago, been state-of-the-art telecommunications machines. Speaking of which, people in virtual media networks and different media outlets today have been talking about one presidential candidate over the other. Who would make a better U.S. president, in other words, for solving the crisis between Iran and America? Iranian politicians, however, believe it makes no difference whether a Democrat or Republican are in power in America, because U.S. foreign policymakers don't understand the importance of Iran in the region and try to control it. They still try to control it, and this is a policy shared by Democrats and Republicans. The only difference is mostly in their rhetoric. Whatever one might say of the Democrats, Republican Trump got to represent the same party that led the United States during the Iraq-Iran war.
We do know that Reagan, U.S. president at the time, did not withhold any assistance to Iraq and against the Iranian people. It is now clear that the United States knew at the time about Iraq's chemical arsenal and Saddam's intent to use it, and even knew where the targets were. At the same time, the United States attacked Iranian ships in the Persian Gulf dozens of times.
The U.S.'s foreign policy relies on two pillars, building consensus and stirring intimidation. Some U.S. administrations, like the Trump administration, are focused on intimidation. He believes that the U.S.'s economic power would make the world obey its orders. He doesn't care about the world's reactions. He's assured that foreign companies would not cooperate with Iran. That is the intimidating aspect of U.S. foreign policy. If we assume Biden to be willing to continue Obama's policy, the U.S. would turn to consensus building once more. He will join global coalitions, improve ties with the European Union, and make efforts to satisfy China and Russia.
To the Europeans, the good thing about it is they don't want an absolute breakdown in Iran.
One reason why the Europeans are defending Iran's cause is that if Iran is weakened too much to reach implosion, a power vacuum would be created, which would cause chaos and repeat Iraqi and Syrian scenarios in Iran. The consequences would be very much heavier than earlier thought.
Mr. Salimi Namin is a historian with an interestingly different but convincing understanding of occurrences to what I'd learned before.
We were a nation with empty hands, but we pinned down the Americans. Before the Islamic Revolution, we had no arms. But after this nation strengthened its determination to end the U.S. hegemony, it succeeded. Today we are highly capable. We can overpower the U.S.'s most sophisticated weapons in the region and discredit the U.S. technology. With such a potential, we can naturally resist the U.S. bullying further.
Should the U.S. succeed in taming Iran, would it not be catastrophic for this region? I mean, it doesn't seem to be so obvious to our neighbors, who are actually shaking hands with Israel today.
The U.S. has long focused on two issues in the region, energy security and Israeli security. Relying on these two strategic issues, the U.S. is justifying its presence in the region. Following the Islamic Revolution in Iran, the Americans have felt a threat to the Israeli security on the part of Iran. The Islamic Revolution accelerated the trend of revival of Palestinian ideals. It also revived Muslim dignity and independence. It also offered a new and reasonable interpretation of nationalism and territory.
Going back to the earlier days of the Pahlavi Shah Mohammad Reza, a newly modernized developing country like Iran would have to choose a side between the Eastern and Western superpowers of the Cold War era. And while the Soviet Union merged nations into its ideological bloc, the U.S. indirectly colonized them with the promise of sharing in economic prosperity. Even if not fairly in an equal partnership with the U.S., sovereign borders would be respected. But our historian here decisively objects to what he sees as a delusion.
When France was to sign an agreement to develop subway stations in Iran, the U.S. ambassador opposed and the agreement was not signed. On the nuclear issue, the Americans were opposed, even to the research plant. You must know that France was giving Iran the technology. It was the Soviet Union that gave Iran the steel technology. The Americans refused to provide us with the steel production technology that was the motor of all industries.
That is not the only reason why many an Iranian has suspected the honesty of U.S. policy for decades before the revolution even. It began with what's known as the 1953 coup that toppled the oil nationalization era Prime Minister Mossadegh. Of the other prominent reasons for Iranian distrust, some are Iran's adoption of the capitulation bill, which went on from October the 13th, 1964 to November the 4th, 1964. It was brief, as it was an intervention both the administration was largely reluctant about and the people were infuriated by. Next is the U.S.'s endeavors to cause the failure of the Islamic Revolution. The highlight would be January the 28th, 1979. After the U.S. realized that Iran's new governing system would not be bent into the ally it had hoped. third would be the US's provoking separatism among ethnic groups. We are referring more to 1979 to 1980. However, that's a ploy the US inherited from European powers of past. Fourth would be the US's issuing of resolutions against Iran and sheltering the Shah or deposed king in 1980 for cancer treatment. I leave the most current reason to return to in a bit. Before getting back to where we were, I give you Shahrzad for a look at what other media outlets have to say.
Hi, my name is Shahrzad Manoucheri, and we'll be reviewing the latest update on Iran's successful resistance against the U.S.'s bullying. In an article by the Rusi, we witness Iran and the U.S., the long and arduous diplomatic road. Under severe economic pressure, the Iranian government is not about to collapse. To the contrary, having survived the worst of the U.S.'s maximum pressure attempts, it is showing a certain degree of confidence in its own resilience. Economic pressure is devastating in the long run, but Iran can live with it in the short term. Furthermore, Iran now sees China and Russia as providing it with a border strategic option, a prop to rely on at the UN, and a counterbalance to US and European pressure. It is true that Iran has remained in the JCPOA in the hope of fully restoring it. Still, there is a faction in Tehran, which is quite vocal in the parliament, that wants Iran to leave the JCPOA and even the non-proliferation treaty. Furthermore, even among those who support the JCPOA, there is still significant worry about Biden. Their argument is just as Obama used his popularity with Europe and was more successful than Bush in increasing sanctions on Iran, Biden too can gain European support in isolating Iran. The Financial Tribune reports Tehran will not surrender to American demands. The United States' purpose is to impose its strategies and policies through pressure, but the Iranian nation will never surrender to U.S. demands, a top general said. They want to bring Iran to the negotiating table, and the result of these negotiations has already been determined as Iran's surrender to the U.S., which is never in accordance with our country's morals, Chief of Staff of the Armed Forces Mohammad Bagheri said in a video conference in Tehran. By accepting the JCPOA, Iran compromised with the world and agreed to reduce part of its tasks to enjoy a reduction of sanctions. The whole world admits that Iran adhered to its commitments, but the U.S. non-adherence complicated the affairs, Bagheri said. Iran waited for a year, but then adopted a policy of active resistance, according to the general, by focusing on self-sufficiency. Merit News Agency claims Trump's insult will unite Iranians against U.S. bullying. Calling Trump's insults as a sign of anger over the ineffectiveness of U.S. foreign policy, the chairman of Iran's Strategic Council on Foreign Relations said, such moves will make Iranians more united in resisting U.S. bullying. Kamal Kharrazi made the remarks in reaction to the recent anti-Iran insults of the U.S. president, adding Trump's insulting words are a sign of his anger and dissatisfaction with the ineffectiveness of sanctions and the failure to achieve U.S. goals against Iran. Not only such ill-mannered behavior will never help the U.S. to achieve its goals, but also it will make Iranian nation more united in the path of resisting U.S. bullying and unilateralism, he said. The U.S. has intended to bring Iran to its knees through imposing new sanctions and redoubled pressure, he said. He added, the main U.S. policy towards Iran is the maximum pressure that the result of which was U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA, reimposition of anti-Iran sanctions, and assassination of General Soleimani. That's all for this segment. We'll see you next week.
The last reason I'm here to give for Iranian suspicion towards America is the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, which appeared to be a center for espionage and conspiracy. We're talking the 1960s and 70s. That's what led to the embassy staffers being taken prisoner by students who had stormed the embassy. They were set free 444 days later on January the 21st, 1981, just hours after President Reagan delivered his inaugural address. This incident may be what cost Jimmy Carter a second term as president. So Iran may complain about the U.S. interfering in its affairs before the revolution and trying to rein this country in since the revolution. But whatever policy the U.S. adopts towards Iran reflects back on itself. Perhaps that is why America thinks or appears to think that Iran interfered with its 2020 elections.
In the contemporary history, the trend has been reversed for the first time. It was the Americans and Britons who decided who had to become prime minister in Iran. But now, Iran is accused of interfering with the US presidential election. The claims that Iran is sending emails are untrue, but the fact is that we are influential in the US election. I mean that many of those who are fighting against racism in the US are inspired by the Islamic Revolution.
Now I have spoken for reason for Iranian suspicion towards America. The Iranians, with their long history, are tolerant and understanding of political turbulence. But the Iraq-Iran war and how the U.S. aided and abetted the aggressor Saddam Hussein against Iran are cause for hatred even.
Rivalry and even conflict between Iran and the U.S. may lie under the same opposition to a political interpretation of Islam. In the other words, since before the end of Second World War, we saw Islamist tendencies with political approaches in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood. We see it even during the constitutional revolution in Iran, Sayyid Jamal Asadabadi. A sort of return to self or religious revisionism was crystallized in the Islamic Revolution, and Imam Khomeini symbolized protests against the political, economic, and social system.
U.S. aggression aside, the lack of affinity between the two states is actually natural, going by the nature of Iran's political constitution post-revolution. This can be summarized in one aspect as follows. Iran's effort to become a free independent state based on the Republic and Islam versus U.S. attempts to return Iran to being a country serving the West in any way possible.
We face with the reality. The U.S. does not like Iran as it is now. The U.S. expects fundamental changes in Iran in order to allay its pressure. Mr. Pompeo has said on several occasions that Iran should become a normal nation. What they mean is something similar to pre-revolution Iran or some regional nations. Due to such problems, Iran's efforts to allay pressure have failed.
And as long as it deems necessary, Iran just won't say yes to no resistance. After years of U.S. sanctions, interference, and espionage. In fact, the room behind me is where U.S. diplomats held their secret meetings. Talking of sanctions have in fact made Iranian rulership's rhetoric more decisive. They are now talking of industrial independence, not just from the West, but also from Iran's own oil economy. The economic blow that Iran suffered through the oil embargo, among other things, showed the Iranian authorities more and more that they must free the country's economy from dependence on one type of income. Iran once showed in facing Obama's sanctions that it can withstand such restrictions. On the other hand, Iran's self-reliance with this process can become a model for other countries.
The U.S. pressure campaign has not been successful. The Iranian economy has not collapsed. Iran's regional and defense policies have not changed. Iran's JCPOA approach has not changed either. Iran has even distanced itself from hazardous nucleus materials. But the Trump administration thinks differently, and its aides say the pressure campaign against Iran has been successful, and Iran is on the cusp of change.
Iran's resistance caused an awakening among other regional states, and this turned into an axis of resistance. Bye for now.
Did you really read all those books, or is it just to make an impression?
My sisters love those books. I really think you might like them. And I'm willing to be directed as well.
How much are you familiar with the books in the bookshelves of the Muslim libraries in the world?
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on RIB English Radio with Brother Hussein, a book lover and a student of Tarbiyat Mudarris University of Tehran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters, the avid readers out there, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You've tuned into IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. The show is Bookshelf, and I'm Hussein. I'm here if you're looking for a good book to read this week. It might have happened to you as well, and if not, you may still be able to visualize this. Someone lives on your street or in your neighborhood for years. You see him at least once a day and habitually nod to him as you pass by, and years pass by. Until one day, you accidentally get an opportunity to sit down with him and become familiar with his ideas, his views and his feelings, his likes and dislikes. You're amazed at what you have come to know about him. You never imagined or guessed that he might be as you found him, and never thought that he was what you later discovered him to be. After that, your attitude and belief about him completely changes. You see him in a different way, and you recognize his beliefs as honorable and trustworthy. We hear a lot about Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam, occasionally hearing a few narrations from him or a few anecdotes of his life here and there. But seldom do we sit down with Ali and listen to him through the books and collections that gather Amir al-Mu'mineen's statements. The Nahj al-Balagha is one of the greatest collections of Amir al-Mu'mineen's speeches, a book that probably all of you have heard of, nodded at from time to time. But have you ever read the Nahj al-Balagha carefully? It is a collection of sermons delivered by Ali, letters sent by him, and pieces of narrations from the Imam. Although the main theme of the book is Ali's uncompeted eloquence and his dominance over language, but Ali offers deep and affecting advice. Reading this, but carefully, changes your entire perspective of the world you live in, and frankly, it turns you into a different person. I insist once again, the book needs to be read carefully, along with contemplation and rumination. Today we want to introduce a book about Amir al-Mu'mineen's Nahj al-Balagha. Stay tuned.
Time of the prophet, there lived a man of excellence. He was the lantern of guidance, who brought an end to
Welcome back to IRIB English Radio. This is Bookshelf, and we are talking about the Nahj al-Balagha. The universe of Nahj al-Balagha is a collection of sermons, letters, and narrations from Ali, and it includes numerous worlds: the world of disattachment from worldly pleasures and piety, the world of worship and knowledge, the world of wisdom, of moral preaching and guidance, of political and social responsibilities, of heroism and bravery. Too many worlds to be conquered by any single individual other than Ali. Today's book is called Glimpses of Nahj al-Balagha by the late Murtada Mutahhari, translated by Ali Quli Qara'i and published by Tahrik-e Tahsir al-Quran. Murtada Mutahhari is one of the most influential contemporary scholars in Iran. He lived to see the Islamic Revolution but was martyred by a terrorist attack. Murtada Mutahhari is a respected scholar known for his prolific publications, deep insight, and honorable methods of reasoning. So I have the book in front of me right now. It comes in 251 pages. This book is divided into 7 parts. The introduction analyzes the literary excellence and multidimensionality of Nahj al-Balagha, quoting various viewpoints expressed about Imam Ali's eloquence in general and as expressed in the book in particular. The other parts analyze the Nahj al-Balagha in various other themes. Now, after the break, I'm going to be reading page 18 from this book, which is about Ali's versatility. You can download the book Glimpses of Nahj al-Balagha by Murtada Mutahhari from al-islam.org and join us in the reading. We'll be back. Don't go away.
Ali
We're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Bookshelf, and we are covering the book Glimpses of Nahj al-Balagha. I'm going to be reading an excerpt from page 18, which is about Ali's versatility. One of the outstanding characteristics of Imam Ali's sayings, which have come down to us in the form of Nahj al-Balagha, is that such sayings are not confined to any particular field alone. Ali alayhi salam, in his own words, has not trodden one single path only, but has covered diverse grounds which occasionally are quite antithetical. Nahj al-Balagha is a masterpiece, but not the kind which excels in one single field, such as the epic, the ghazal, the sermon, the praise, the satire, or the love poetry. Rather, it covers multifarious fields, as shall be elaborated on. In fact, works which are masterpieces in a particular field do indeed exist. Nevertheless, their number is not great, and they are countable. The number of works which cover numerous subjects but are not masterpieces is quite large. But the characteristic that a work be simultaneously a masterpiece without restricting itself to any one particular subject is an exclusive merit of Nahj al-Balagha. With the exception of the Holy Qur'an, which is altogether a different subject to be dealt with independently, what masterpiece is comparable to the Nahj al-Balagha's versatility? Speech is the spirit's envoy, and the words of a man relate to the sphere in which his spirit dwells. Naturally, a speech which pertains to multiple spheres is characteristic of a spirit which is too creative to be confined to a single sphere. Since the spirit of Ali alayhi salam is not limited to a particular domain, but encompasses various spheres, and he, in the terminology of Islamic mystics, is al-insan al-kamil, the perfect man, al-kawn al-jami', the complete microcosm, jami' kull al-hadarat, the possessor of all higher virtues, so his speech is not limited to any one particular sphere. Accordingly, as we should say, in terms current nowadays, that Ali's merit lies in the multidimensional nature of his speech, and it is different from one-dimensional works. The all-embracing nature of Ali's spirit and his speech is not a recent discovery. It is a feature which has invoked a sense of wonder since at least 1,000 years.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Unfortunately, that is all the time that I have. Just like to add something that the unfamiliarity of a Sunni scholar with the Nahj al-Balagha wouldn't be surprising. What is surprising is that the Nahj al-Balagha should be a stranger and alien in its own homeland, among the Shia of Ali. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. This was Bookshelf. We introduced the book Glimpses of Nahj al-Balagha by Murtaza Mutahhari, which you can download from al-islam.org. You can also download an archive of this episode and our previous episodes from our website. Simply search IRIB English Radio Bookshelf. Until next week, and a lot of reading. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
what you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.